will come to order. I don't believe we have a quorum yet, so we're going to start with testimony. Mark Kupski, are you here? Please. Welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name for the tape, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Mark Krupski. I'm the Director of Property Records and Licensing in Olmsted County. It's a pleasure to be here today. I thank you for the opportunity to share, Chairman and committee. I've been asked by the Minnesota Association of County Officers to weigh in on the two bills before the Senate concerning voter IDs, Senate File 479 and Senate File 509. I kind of ran some numbers. It's what I do with some of my tax duties and appraisal information. So I looked at the population of Minnesota. We have 18 and over, about 4 million people. And just some things to consider. Supporting documents to obtain a Minnesota photo ID at present includes certified birth certificates that cost $26 and certified copy of marriage license if a person's birth certificate doesn't match the name because of marriage. So they may need that, and that costs $9. So in many cases, supporting documents could cost $35 just to obtain a free ID card. Also, the current cost of a Minnesota photo ID card is $18. I did some research and read some reports from indicating that Indiana had approximately 168,000 voter IDs for the 2010 election, and that represented about 3.48% of their population of 18 and over. They have a population of 4.8 million 18 and over. So if I applied that same percentage of 3.48% to Minnesota, which has a population of 4,005,417 people, I estimated about 139,348 voter IDs would be needed. And this, I came at it from a different direction from the Secretary of State's office on their fiscal note. They noted about 144,000 voter IDs would be needed. The cost to get a voter ID, even if it's free, there's still cost either at the local level, and this could be considered unfunded mandate for the labor that's involved in that. But it could cost anywhere from up to $35 just with supporting documentation to get that ID. But just for sake of argument, I'm going to use, let's say, an average of $25 to obtain a voter ID. Could put these costs upwards of $4 to $5 million to carry out the voter IDs. In addition to this, there would be voter outreach would be necessary. And in this, I did check with our counterparts in the state of Arizona. They had a citizens initiative in 2004 for a voter ID, and that went into effect for the 2006, 2008, and 2010 election. And as a result of that, they do that now, but they also permit various forms of ID, not just photo ID. If a party does not have a photo ID, they'll allow a bank statement along with, say, a recent utility bill. So it's something that would not be as stringent and would be easier for the citizens to do that. But in spite of all that, in 2008, they had a voter turnout of about 2.3 million, and of that, they had 2,547 conditional provisional ballots that weren't counted because the people did not show up. They had 5 days to show up with the identification that they did not have at the polls. So essentially 2,000 or about 0.1% of the population that voted in Arizona were disenfranchised as a result of the provisional ID. Additional costs to administer the photo IDs, I estimated that it would cost probably at least one election judge more. My counterparts think I'm a little low on this, and they feel it should be two. But if it was just one statewide with over 4,000 precincts needing extra election judges, And I was using $10 an hour. They were using $8, so my S might be a little high. But I come up with an added cost of $1,240,800. And if we go with what my counterparts suggest, you're looking at $2.5 million. The Secretary of State's office strongly emphasized the importance of meeting the 42-day requirement that all voter registrations be entered in the SVR system after the election. And I'm pleased to report that Olmsted County made that date. However, we didn't do it by not hiring extra staff. We ended up hiring three additional staff that cost us $9,000. And this was for the 2008 election, where we had 5,371 same-day registrations. In 2008, we had over 13,000 same-day registrations. So based on that, we would need to hire seven additional staff to get those entered, and we would go from an additional cost in 2008 of $9,000 to about $21,000. And please keep in mind, this is just one out of 87 counties. The cost to do that entering was about $1.67 per entry, and so if somebody has the number of what the statewide same-day registrations, that might be a fair number to use. Senate File 479 ultimately allows voters who submitted a provisional ballot to sign an affidavit that they were unable to afford the cost to obtain the voter ID. This only serves to inconvenience the voter and begs the question of why a signed oath at the polls is not permissible. However, to do so later is permissible. Another administrative concern of Senate File 509 would be election judges to enter same-day registrations into electronic poll book for those jurisdictions that meet the population requirements. The City of Rochester typically employs about 400 election judges per election to meet the needs of 45 precincts. Election judges may attend either 2 or 3 hour training sessions once every 2 years. Central processing by fewer well-trained personnel versus many personnel with minimal training would be optimal. I feel that this central poll book, if there were entering same-day registrants, could produce quite a few errors, and somebody would be responsible for cleaning up those errors. Section 3 of Article 1 of Senate File 509 removes the ability to show a current utility bill or demonstrate a voter's residence along with a photo ID that may just show who the person is. Let's say somebody had moved, the photograph would be the person, but they don't live there. I think that would be a mistake. It would add an unnecessary burden. And that I'll also mention that the state of Arizona and their citizens initiative allowed multiple forms of ID so as to make it more available or easier for the citizens to comply. So an example would be in Arizona, I could show an ID with a photo that has my current address, or I can show a photo that doesn't have my current address, but say a bank statement that shows that address, or a current bank statement or utility bill, or I could show two forms of non-photo ID that's acceptable, such as the bank statement or utility bill, and then I'd be allowed to vote. Senate File 509 also increases the retention period to store the election materials, including ballots, from 22 to 36 months. Olmsted County, we pay to store our election equipment as well as those ballots, so this could increase our cost on storing, since typically 22 months you're able to dispose of the past election and move on to the next one. So this would add to those storage costs. Section 19 of Article 2, 509 states that the tabulation of vote totals from a precinct where excess ballots were removed from the ballots box shall be completed by the canvassing board responsible for certifying election results from that period. I am not certain how well this would work in practice. Presently, all precincts have been balanced on the election abstract prior to when the canvassing board meets. If more than one precinct experiences excess ballots, the canvassing board may have difficulties completing the canvassing boards on time. I believe this needs further clarification. Article 3 of 509 employs a network approach for electronic rosters and contingency plans that include printed rosters. This cancels any possible savings on the printing costs that were mentioned in that video that was shown on Monday, because that had to be printed for that contingency plan, as well as increase in the cost overall with this network poll book. Also, the network approach only includes larger populations as it's been revised. Therefore, it reduces the possibility of cross-checking dramatically. And if we're trying to catch if voters were voting, in multiple locations. Networked electronic rosters prevent serious technical challenges with minimal benefits. If we were to do poll
Mr.
books,
Krupski,
I would favor a poll book that was not networked.
Mr. Krupski,
both types are expensive.
If you could finish up, we're trying to keep it to about 3 minutes, so you've been about 10. But it's good testimony. So
if you could indulge me just a little bit, I've traveled far to come up here, and I've spent hours.
Okay.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
No comments from the audience, please. We'll be respectful here. I understand that, and if you could,
I will finish
wrapping it up
within
fine.
60 minutes, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. The Article 4 states that frivolous challenges. Any challenges during recount cannot be frivolous, and they need to have justification. However, the canvassing board only has the authority to challenge a frivolous ballot. This takes away the local jurisdiction of that and brings it up to the state level, and it demonstrates a lack of confidence in the local election officials. Lastly, the provisional ballots will add quite a bit of duties to the election officials. We got away from processing absentee ballots. It reduced errors. We've had central processing. This kind of undoes that by having provisional ballots at the all the polling places where you have up to 30,000 election judges handling these. It makes it subject to many more errors. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Other questions? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for allowing Mr. Krupski to finish his testimony. I always appreciate it when people from my district come forward, and I know you've given this a lot of thought. I have one question for you, Mr. Krupski. I know you mentioned the concern about folks who might have a photo ID but not for the exact place that maybe they had just moved to.
Correct.
And certainly we never want to deter any eligible voters from voting. We want them all to vote at the polls. I guess my question is, do you feel that the provisions in the bill regarding provisional ballots, I think it's about Section 10, page 9, would address that concern?
Mr. Krupski.
Senator Nelson, I would have to reread that. This was a 42-page bill, and I've read it and read and read it, but I still need to read it. But it's my belief that provisional balloting ultimately can result in disenfranchising voters, especially voters that take the time to vote, yet have to come back again. Maybe they're not allowed to take up work and things of that nature. So I believe provisional ballot just adds another whole layer of administration that I think it would be much more efficient as administrative elections to avoid.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Maybe we can follow up on that piece offline.
Be happy to.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony and for coming today. Secretary Ritchie is here, so would you come up, please? Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mark Ritchie, and I have the honor of serving you and all Minnesotans as your Secretary of State. The two bills before you are, of course, quite different. There have been a lot of testimony about them, and so it's hard to do it all in a very short period of time, but I do want to be brief. The thing that they do share and that I share is the desire to address any problems of people who are not eligible to be voting in our state. They also have other objectives as well, but they share that particular goal, and it's a goal that I share. So the concern that I have is, does it actually get us to that point? Will these two bills, whether the cost is $5 million or $50 million, it's who knows, but will it get us to that to that point? And one of my main concerns is that the one issue that we know is a problem in our state, and we know it really from all the data that we have, is that we have a certain number of particularly young people who are recently out of prison who don't know or forget that that they're not eligible to vote, and they vote before they are in fact eligible, and that is in fact itself a felony. And when they are, confronted with that, they're typically charged with another felony, or perhaps it's lower to a gross misdemeanor, but it, again, disrupts their lives, and it is bad for our system in general. And because these bills are focused on photo identification, driver's licenses, or related identifications, which in no way include that information, these bills do not get to what I consider a very serious problem. And let me say why I think this is serious. First, of course, we don't want any votes that are ineligible voters inside of our system. On Election Day 2008, a very good example of how this can happen. A young man in Wool Road who was recently out of prison, 21, 22 years old, was getting his life back together, was very proud of what he was doing to put his life in order, called his parole officer, got the voicemail and said, hey, I'm getting my life in order. I'm going to be a good citizen. I'm going over to vote. He happened to be a strong supporter of Senator Coleman and Senator McCain, but he was seeing this as being a good citizen, and he went and voted. By the time his parole officer got the message and called him and said, don't, it was too late. And so this young man's vote was in the system, of course. That's not good. Second, of course, it costs a lot of money for the county to investigate, to arrest, to jail. He got 30 days in jail to prosecute, all of those costs. And then finally, it knocked him off his game of trying to get back into the mainstream, back into society in an orderly way. And so for those reasons and many others, we want to find ways to address that serious problem. And we know that it's in each election cycle several dozen. And so he was fortunate in one way. He argued very successfully, as has been shown in the various newspaper articles, that he wasn't told. He did not know this, and so they reduced the charge to gross misdemeanor. And the legislature last session heard that story, and you and both houses passed on a very strong bipartisan basis a very low-cost process that would have helped address this in the future, requiring judges, correction officials to inform everyone coming out. It is a little confusing because other states, if you're in prison, you can't vote, but if you're out of prison, you can. So we have a slightly different system than our neighbors. But in any case, that bill was vetoed, but I understand it's moving again. That would be a bill that would make a positive impact on reducing the number of people who are not eligible but who do vote in our system. And again, it's that shared goal of those two bills that I share of reducing the number of people who are voting and not eligible that I would like to see addressed in elections legislation. With very short time today, of course, it's not possible to go through it all. So let me end with kind of my main message. And I've been trying to share this, and I really appreciate that many of you have given me time on your busy schedules to talk one-on-one. My message is that last legislative session, the legislature and the governor celebrated the passage of some very, very remarkable election legislation. It took a long time to get to it. There were many meetings over the interim between 2009 and 2010 where people, with the assistance of the Humphrey Institute and local election officials and county, really did craft carefully bills that addressed shared goals. I believe that process was very successful. The governor and I don't agree, or Governor Pawlenty and I don't agree on everything, but I totally agreed with him when he demanded that he would, send back legislation that was not bipartisan and wasn't well developed. He made that a kind of line in the sand. Governor Carlson before him had the same line in the sand. Governor Dayton has the same line in the sand, which is election law is different than many other kinds of policy. It needs to be broadly supported within the legislature on a bipartisan basis. Governor Pawlenty's insistence on that standard forced a discussion process that resulted in really excellent legislation, and it gave us all a chance to come together and celebrate. That process could take place over this coming winter, over the interim session. And I've spoken to some of you and spoken to members on the House side about that process. I've spoken to the people at the Humphrey Institute about whether they would be willing to be helpful. I think there is a lot of goodwill about agreeing on those goals. And some of the goals are about dealing with actual problems. Some of the goals are dealing with perceptions. You know, we have things that we need to do. That process, I believe, would get us to a bill that then the governor would be excited about signing and that all of us would feel very proud about being part of crafting like we were in 2010. We made it possible for our soldiers to vote. We made it possible for our election officials to do their job better and more efficiently. Many good things came from that process. I believe we could do it again. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you again for your time. I'll stop right there. We're on a short schedule today. If there are any questions, I'll be very happy to take them or follow-up questions at any time, day or night. I'm happy to respond. So thank you again, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I just have three brief questions, and I'd just like brief answers. But you mentioned that these two bills had to do with photo ID, and you said, and they also had other objectives. And I'm just wondering what you thought those objectives were. And then I couldn't tell exactly. I understood you to say that you don't think these bills would cover all the areas that you're concerned about, but I don't know if you actually addressed your stance on these bills. And the third question is a little, you might need to tell me later. I'd like to know how many HAVA dollars we have, and if there's anything that would preclude those HAVA dollars from being used to implement some of these voting ID, photo ID, electronic measures. And if there is, I would really like to see those in writing. And thank you so much.
Yes, ma'am. Secretary Ritchie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Nelson, the first question, I don't know all the other objectives, but the larger of the two bills repeals all election law regulations or rules that exist on all aspects of elections. So that's a fairly big and very comprehensive thing to repeal all rules related to elections. So I don't know the necessarily specifics of the objective of doing that. But in any case, that one of the bills is an omnibus bill, a very large bill. So we could go through that more specifically. You ask about, I oppose both bills and two parts of that, just to be brief. One, they don't address felon voting, which I think is the single issue of people ineligible who are voting. And second, they are so full of loopholes that the requirement is, it's kind of the thing that you could drive a truck through. You can either impose the requirement of showing an ID on all voters, so absentee mail, all that, or you can require it of some voters. So in these two bills, there are loopholes, a religious objection, whatever that means, people who decide to vote by absentee to get around the law, people who happen to live in one of the 300 vote-by-mail precincts, people who are wanting to skirt the law, who vote provisional, and then go in the following week with a yellow slip from DMV that they use to circumvent the system. There's all kinds of loopholes. And I raise those only to say that writing election legislation at this level takes a lot of time and discussion, and I experienced that in the last session. My expectation is that spending a fair amount of time with local people and township and county and with experts could craft good legislation, but these two bills don't address the issue that I think is disrupting the lives of some of our young people and costing counties money and putting votes into the system like the young man who voted for Senator McCain and Senator Coleman from War Road. It doesn't do that, but it costs quite a bit of money. Finally, on HAVA, the HAVA plan does not include the spending of money in this area, but we have a letter that we've prepared already on this, and I can make sure that you have a copy of that right away because it was prepared for Representative Downey on the House side.
So just let me make sure I heard right. So there's nothing in HAVA that would preclude moving, using HAVA dollars to implement photo ID or electronic ballot.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, there are many things in the bill, in the HAVA bill, that would preclude that.
Oh, and if you could show me those items, please. Thank you.
Mr. Secretary, you said that Senate File 509 won't address the felon votes. Mm-hmm. It looks like the verification process created by the bill does address the felon voters. Or you don't agree that the electronic solution, the electronic poll book, will work to deal with that problem?
Mr. Chairman, as we've talked to the people at the CrimNet organization, which is Minnesota's closest analogous situation to this online, step-by-step, real-time communications vehicle, they pointed out to me that to have actual access to felony data, you have to have access to the FBI's felony file, which is the one good file. And it takes background checks on all people with access to that file, which for us is about 30,000 people. So building in the requirement for background checks on our 30,000 election judges before they could access a fully operational, real-time file of felons is not something included in the bill and would be quite problematic to actually do that in the state of Minnesota. And sometime I would recommend testimony from our friends at CrimNet about what it takes to actually do what's being imagined in this process. I have some ideas of cheaper ways that are sort of 95% solutions that don't require the sort of background check requirements that are being built in, but it would take some months to deal with the legal side and the technology side and the money side to come up with a good idea. But I'm really interested in finding that good idea and making sure that other young people like this young man up north don't make that kind of mistake again.
Hey, thank you. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ritchie, we talked a few minutes ago, and I think I just wanted to make sure that people know that you and I are pretty good acquaintances. And believe it or not, he has the same sense of humor I have, which is really scary when I think about it.
Actually, that's a little surprising, Senator. We didn't know you had one.
Oh. There's three of us.
See? Yeah.
Excuse me.
Senator Vandeveer is beginning to show his wry sense of humor, too. The question I did have, and I don't want to get into the deep in the weeds on the bill beyond what you've said. The only question I have is, I know that Representative Kiffmeyer created a delete everything amendment, which I employed at our last committee meeting. And I think it was middle of last week we asked for a fiscal note on that. I haven't seen one yet, and I was just wondering when that might be coming.
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chair, if I may address this.
May.
Thank you. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. And the fiscal note was actually not requested until during Monday's hearing. It was not requested last week. So when I got back to the office on, you know, late Monday afternoon, the request was sitting there and we began work on it. But we have not completed it. We've done two fiscal notes for this bill already, one for yours as introduced, one for Representative Kiffmeyer's original delete all amendment, and we're now working on the third fiscal note for your delete all amendment. But right. We haven't had time to complete it yet. And we do expect to have it in the next day or so.
All right.
Okay, thank you. Senator Ritchie, I do have one more couple questions. What's the purpose of the PVC cards?
Mr. Chairman, the postal verification card is used after somebody has registered to vote, either by mail, coming up to the counter on election day, and it's mailed out as a way to determine the whether the people who data entered the card properly read, sometimes hard to read writing, and whether the address in fact is a legitimate address, a complete address, a proper address. And if we find that there are returns on that, because it's a non-forwardable postal verification card, the county auditors who receive those back spend the time to determine if there was a typo or they had a misprint or something like that. And any that cannot be corrected are marked as challenged and turned over to county attorneys for further investigation. And in this last year's legislature, the legislature requested a report, and we prepared that report, and we can make copies available to everyone right now if that would be useful to you or to the committee.
So, Mr. Secretary, when they're returned, what is that? Actually, how many of them were returned after 2008 and 2010?
Mr. Chair and members, the cards are returned to the counties, and so we don't actually have a figure on the number of cards that are returned. But because people move, it's not surprising that cards are returned. In this report, which we have for 2010, we were not asked to create it for 2008. The counties reported to us the number of cards that were returned where they could not verify the voter's eligibility for people that had registered and voted on Election Day. And the number for 2010 is 399 have been turned over to county attorneys for further investigation. So it's not, so these haven't been fully investigated yet. I mean, so it's not necessarily even 399 problems, but that's the number that where they could not determine if the person was eligible.
Thank you. Any other questions for the Secretary? Seeing none, thank you for your
thank you very much.
Today. Kent Solem, are you here? Would you come up, please? Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kent Solem, General Counsel for the Minnesota Association of Townships. Thank you for this opportunity to testify on both bills. I want to just start by saying that we are not here to debate the policy behind the photo ID, but strictly focusing on the administrative and fiscal side of the bill. Our association does not have a policy regarding the policy issue of whether photo ID is a good concept or not, but we do have serious concerns with the administrative burdens and costs with both bills. Even though we were exempted out from the Polbick portion of Senator Limmer's bill, we are still subject to all the other provisions. And you've already heard testimony a great deal about the provisional ballots, but for townships in particular, this does end up being a hardship. The extra ballot printing costs, in the rural areas, it's not as simple to obtain the printing. It involves travel to arrange for the formal printing. These ballots may have to meet all the new standards that have been imposed over the last few years. Not simply run off on the local Xerox machine. And so there's extra costs and extra travel. As you've heard, this probably means in order to ensure that the ballot isn't cast with the other ballots, that there's going to need to be a designated judge. You have to have that separate lockbox. All of those things are extra costs. At the township level, it's an extra cost for March elections. It's an extra cost for the November state elections. So it's a double whammy. Even though the individual dollar amounts may not look a lot like a high amount, when you start tallying them all up and then realizing you have to do this for multiple elections, for small rural communities, it does become a financial burden. We've had a number of groups in, many of our folks saying that they support the concept of photo ID, and then when we walk them through the administrative process and the costs that are involved, they say, well, that's not what we want. That's not the bill we were thinking it was. We just want to flash an ID and check us in and vote and don't have provisional ballots and don't have the other things. And when we try to walk them through the problems with that, they say, well, for now, just don't do a bill. So even when they're supporting the concept, they don't support either one of these bills once we walk them through it. And I think that you'd find that true once you walk through the details with most people who think they support the concept. There's some provisions that I think are very ambiguous in the bill. And in this case, I'm referring to Senator Limmer's bill. There's a provision that right now there's a provision that says we must try or that we may try to verify age of certain voters that had I think it's 1983 registrations. That becomes a mandate, but doesn't say how we're supposed to try. Do we have to just try to ask everybody? Do we have to do mass mailings that would add extra costs? I don't know how I'm supposed to tell people what that really means. There's a provision that says we must provide the notice of our Board of Canvas meetings on our websites, not may provide, must provide. Most of my members don't have websites. I don't know how, I'm not going to tell them to go to the expense of creating a website to post extra notice, which raises the issue of the notice itself. With the changes in order to accommodate provisional ballots, we're going to have a separate Board of Canvas meeting at a later date, which delays the results of the election. It requires the extra notice. It requires extra costs for the extra travel time coming back to do the Board of Canvas, the meeting time itself. And again, that's done both for the March elections and the November state elections. So it's a double cost for our folks. There's a provision that requires for absentee ballot boards that they be open for a set number of nights, even if there are no ballots. Under current law, they only meet if there is a ballot received, and they only have to meet once every third day. This would require them to be open every night for the absentee ballot provision. That means we have to figure out how to have business hours, where to have business hours, and how to pay the clerk and the election judges to be there even if nothing comes in. And that's an unwarranted cost and an unwarranted change from current law. There are a number of other small provisions like that, but I know that we're short in time, and so I will just stop with the overall that even with the exemption from the polling book place, there are still quite a few hidden costs in this bill to local governments that we simply, in an era where you're cutting our LGA, you're cutting our market value credits, you're cutting our PILT payments, reducing all the state resources to us, and imposing unfunded mandates that simply are not warranted. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Solon? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Matt Smarja. Smarja. I don't think I did very well with your name. Maybe you could repeat it for the tape anyway.
No problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Smariga. That is S-M-R-I-G-A. And I am the Director of Campus Organizing for MSUSA, or the Minnesota State University Student Association. We represent the seven state universities in Minsk. And as the Director of Campus Organizing for MSUSA, I've done a great deal of work on all seven of our campuses, registering voters and promoting the importance of voting to students. And just to be clear, MSUSA is a 501c3, so all of that is done in a completely nonpartisan manner. And I'm here today to share my perspective based on what I've seen while working with literally hundreds of college students to promote the vote about the impact this legislation will have on college campuses. As an association, we spend time and resources on registration and encouraging students to vote because we believe it's essential for students as the future citizens and workers of our state to participate in the political process. And what I've seen during my work on campus is that the number one barrier that prevents a student who has the legal right to vote from actually showing up to the polls is a lack of understanding about the process of voting. Young people who have never voted before seem to find this process intimidating at times. My observation is that there is nothing that undermines a student's motivation to vote more than just simply not knowing the logistical details of how to properly register and cast their ballot. And in fact, the vast majority of time we spend promoting the vote on our campuses must be spent relaying the laws, regulations, and process of how to vote. We must carefully explain how to register, how the student must choose to vote in their home district by absentee ballot or on election day in their campus precinct. We explain exactly where their polling location is on campus and how late it's open on election day, and the list goes on and on. We spend time and energy carefully explaining these things because these are the things that are completely foreign to new voters. And what I've seen is that if a student doesn't have a clear idea in her mind about how to cross all her T's and dot all her I's, if you will, when it comes to voting, her motivation to show up to the polls can easily be undermined. If a student doesn't know just one of the aforementioned details about the voting process, she can easily say to herself, you know, I'll just do it next time. And when that happens, our democracy suffers. It is our duty as the older, already civically engaged citizens to do everything we can to make the political process as inclusive as possible to our fledgling citizens. So, If we add a whole new layer of rules, regulations, and processes with the special photo ID requirement, I know for a fact, based on what I've seen, that it will lead to countless young citizens who have the legal right to vote not showing up at the polls on Election Day. I respectfully ask the committee to bear in mind these severe consequences and weigh the heavy burden this legislation imposes against the actual risk of fraudulent votes being cast. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Seeing none, John Ekblad. Okay, Melissa Andre. Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the tape, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Melissa Andre, and I'm a lead advocate in the shelter at Cornerstone Advocacy Service. We're an agency in Bloomington that provides services to victims and survivors of domestic violence. I organized voting in the 2008 and 2010 elections for clients in our shelter. We facilitated safe voting for victims in shelter using the vouching process. Sorry. I see that someone can't hear me very well. I was just saying that we facilitated safe voting for clients in our domestic violence shelter using the vouching process. We currently work with our county, city, and election judges to submit a list of employees who will vouch for clients, and those employees then bring along a photo ID for themselves to the polls. The Delete All Amendment to Senate File 509 allows for domestic violence shelter residents to present a photo ID with their prior address, along with a signed letter from the facility's administrator that they are currently living in that facility. However, many victims in shelter have fled without their IDs or had their IDs taken from them or the supporting documents as well taken from them by an abuser. Due to the cost and time necessary to recover or reapply for those IDs and supporting documents, many would not be able to get replacement IDs, even with their old addresses, in time for the election. There are also victims who have fled from another state and are not yet able to get a Minnesota ID, even if they've been in the voting precinct a sufficient amount of time to vote, because they're not able to use the shelter's address for safety reasons and because they don't have another address within the state. For these reasons, the amended version of Senate File 509 is not sufficient for victims and survivors in shelter to exercise their guaranteed voting rights. Furthermore, Senate File 479 in its current form does not make any provision for those in domestic violence shelters to vote. That would mean that victims and survivors would need to go back to the precincts they lived in before they were in shelter in order to vote, which can be very unsafe. If the voting option were eliminated, many women would no longer be able to register at the polls and to vote on Election Day. I have personally seen the excitement of women in shelter who want to remain engaged, want to exercise their right to vote. This civic duty is something in which they take a lot of pride. In the 2008 presidential election, 3/4 of the women who were in our shelter at that time went to the polls, which is an incredible turnout for those who are going through a traumatic situation. I saw the excitement again this past fall among those who chose to vote. It's really important to keep this community engaged. They're taking their duty as citizens seriously. I'm asking that you please also take seriously your duty to them and allow them to vote through a vouching process. Thank you, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Members? Okay, seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Roberta Blomster. Blomster. Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the tape, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify before you today. My name is Roberta Blomster, and I'm a self-advocate and person under guardianship in the state. I'm here today because of the changes to the voting laws for people under guardianship that are being proposed in Senate File 509. In February, I testified before the House Government Operations and Elections Committee and got the section removing the right to vote for anyone under guardianship stripped from House File 210. Now I see there are still issues regarding voting rights for people under guardianship being brought up. In 1994, the court order stated I retained the right to vote in my conservator of person order. In 2003, legislation changed the laws regarding conservatorship of the person to guardianship of the person. I continued to vote because the court had given me that right. In 2005, I was informed that under the Minnesota Constitution, people under guardianship do not have the right to vote. I worked hard to get the law changed to allow all people under guardianship the right to vote unless the court order revoked that right. The Minnesota legislature handled the issue of people under guardianship voting in 2005 in the Voter Rights Bill. I truly believe it should be left in the hands of the judge at the time that the guardianship is put in place. The judge will have all pertinent information regarding the individual and their ability to understand the voting process. I come prepared to vote whether it's on primary day or election day. I go online using a variety of websites and Facebook, along with information that I get from the Disability Law Center, Advocate and Change Together, ARC, Merrick My Day Training and Habilitation Program, friends and family to make an informed decision about who I want to vote for. I also watch debates and read about the candidates, and I email them on their stand on issues important to me. To my family and friends, I am known as their legislative / voting expert. I used to vote with assistance. Mom would stand by me in case I had any questions regarding what something meant. Sometimes I would have problems with the way things are worded. She knows me and how to explain things to me so that I understand it. I now download the sample ballots ahead of time, so I vote by myself using the auto mark, and that makes me feel really good. Again, I urge you to protect the right of people under guardianship to vote. Please make sure that a person under guardianship's right to vote is not taken away without a court hearing. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for allowing me to testify today.
Any questions for the witness?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify. I am Anna Blumster. I am Roberta's and Haley's mother and legal guardian. The concerns we have with this bill is it's changing one word. It's saying instead of revoke, reinstate. So would my girls have the right to vote this coming election? Because right now their votes have not been revoked. Suddenly it says reinstate. So do we have to have everyone who's under guardianship back into the courts to get a hearing to allow them to vote this year because of the one-word change? I don't think it's fundamental, the difference, whether it's reinstated or revoked. That's my major issue, because here's my technicality, which really bugs me. My mother, who died of Alzheimer's, had the right to vote till the day she died. She didn't know family. She didn't know friends. She didn't know where she was. But she could vote because she was not under guardianship. I was her power of attorney. No court of law had said she was incapacitated. She could vote. I could take her anywhere, and she would vote for who I said. But that's legal. But yet they want to take a classification of person who is under guardianship, and suddenly you can't vote. One of the other issues, and I'm not sure it's in this vote, but I know it's in an amendment coming around, says that annually when I do the annual report for my wards, it will ask me if I think that they have the right to vote, should it be rescinded, reinstated, or left unchanged. And with that, the court would then issue them a letter saying, your right's been taken away. Without a court hearing is asinine as far as I'm concerned. A judge should be the one to decide with the person in front of them whether they have that capacity to understand a vote. I know on Monday, Senator Kiffmeyer had mentioned her sister who has an IQ of a 4-year-old. That person would never be given by the judge the right to vote in the first place, so she couldn't have been taken to a poll to vote. So I really wish that any language stripping the right to vote or reinstating it, as it says, would be removed from this bill. Thank you. I'm sorry, I'm passionate. I usually don't testify here. Roberta's my speaker. She does all of this stuff. I have never come before a committee before except in February with the same issue.
Well, thank you for coming today. Any questions for the witnesses?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Could Senator Limmer clarify what he believes the bill says in this area?
Senator Limmer.
Chair, Senator Roebling, I believe we removed that language at the last committee hearing. So that doesn't apply right now to this issue. Perhaps counsel can give a clarification on that.
Sure.
Counsel, could you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Limmer, we did remove one provision about assisting voters at the polling place. I believe what we're talking about now is Section 13, and that talks about the challenged eligibility list, and it does make a small change from the current state law, as the testifiers talked about.
That's lines 18 and 19, I believe, or 19 and 20 on page 22.
So
that's of the that's on the SCSO 509 CE1. It says up here. Anything else?
Senator Roebling, did you have,
pardon?
Do you have any questions? Or?
So, Mr. Chair, there is
was
still
your question answered, I guess.
There is still a provision in here that that they are speaking to, and that part has not been changed.
I misspoke, Senator Roebling, and I don't have the 501 or 509 copy that the testifier has. I have a new version that we're moving into later today, and so we can address that in later on in our meeting. I know that it was partially taken care of, but we're still open for discussion later today.
Thank you.
Could all right, we'll come back to this. Apparently, thank you for your testimony. Pam Hoops, please.
Hoops.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
My name is Pamela Hoops, and I'm the legal director of the Minnesota Disability Law Center. And the Minnesota Disability Law Center is part of the Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis. We represent individuals with all types of disabilities throughout the state. I'm here today to share our concerns about the guardianship issues in Senate File 509, and also concerns we have based on our understanding that, Senate File 509, and we are also concerned with issues related that are raised under House File 1119, that our understanding at the end of Monday's hearing was that an amendment to Senate File 509 adding provisions regarding guardianship would be proposed possibly today. The same concerns that the Blomsters raised concern us, and that would be the change of the presumption regarding the ability of people under guardianship to vote and the requirement in some versions of proposed bills that would require annual court reviews of the competence of the ward to vote. Under current law, individuals under guardianship have the right to vote unless a court finds that they are incompetent to vote and takes that right away. The state guardianship statute was revised in 2003 to bring Minnesota law in line with the Uniform Guardianship and Protective Proceedings Act. Now, Minnesota law provides guardians only with the powers required by the ward's limitations and demonstrated needs, with the goal of encouraging the development of the ward's maximum self-reliance and independence. Rather than making a global finding of incompetence in all areas, the court now limits the guardian's powers to particular areas where the ward needs assistance after the ward's inability to make decisions in that area has been proven. Consistent with this modern framework that Minnesota adopted, an individual under guardianship is presumed to have the competence to vote and can vote unless the court makes a finding that the ward is incompetent to vote based on evidence considered by the court. that determination of incompetence to vote becomes part of the guardianship order. We were unable to get data on how many people currently under guardianship in Minnesota have had their right to vote taken away by court order. In any case, the current statutory framework is in line with the court's valid exercise of their authority to preserve a ward's right to vote, even while finding incompetence in other areas of decision-making. This updating was consistent with longstanding judicial recognition of the importance of preserving the fundamental right to vote where possible, even prior to the modernization of Minnesota's guardianship statute, when sweeping guardianship orders were the norm. Courts would appropriately exercise their authority to preserve a ward's right to vote in the guardianship order after reviewing their competency to do so. The provisions of Senate File 509 that the Blomsters were concerned about and provisions related in House File 1119, were that to be offered as an amendment, are simply inconsistent with the updating of the statute and the modern trend toward limiting guardianship. And it removes a presumption that the individual has the right to vote, and contrary to other aspects of decision-making under guardianship, places the burden on the ward to prove their competence to vote. That restriction, focused solely on voting and not other areas of competence, lacks adequate justification, as current law and practice already provide a mechanism for the courts to keep people under guardianship who lack the capacity to vote from voting. This blanket change may invite equal protection challenges from adversely affected individuals. Moreover, the proposed amendment would place an additional heavy burden on the already overburdened court system. There are approximately 23,000 people under guardianship in Minnesota. And, for example, House File 1119's provisions that require an annual court reassessment of competency to vote and an order by the court on the question of voting competence for every single individual under guardianship, regardless of the factual basis for the guardianship, would create an enormous additional administrative and financial burden for the court system. Thank you, and I'm happy to try and answer any questions.
Ms. Phillips, I have a question for you. As I read this, and I'm sure we want to get this right, on 2219 it says, is under a guardianship, and I understand that there's different categories of guardianship, is what I was told. Now, is that correct?
It gets kind of confusing because historically, before 2003, the terminology was different. And before the updating of the guardianship statute, guardianship was the term used only for people who had every right taken away by the court, including the right to vote. And conservatorship was the term used for people who had some rights to make decisions reserved to them. So, for example, I have had clients in the past, before 2003, who had gone to court and been found incompetent to make decisions for themselves in any area, except for one area, for example. And because the court said, well, the person is not competent to make decisions in any particular area, except for they can decide who their friends are, just to make up an example. Or they can decide where they live, some limited area. That would convert the guardianship to a conservatorship. The terminology has now changed, and conservatorship now refers to control over finances, and guardianship is anything to do with personal decision-making that's not financial. Sometimes people use the term limited guardianship, which means that it's some things are considered areas of incompetence. And the way I think of it, without being disrespectful to the process, is almost like a Chinese menu. It used to be that everything was considered incompetent, and unless the court said, but you can still make decisions on this. The modern way of viewing that Minnesota adopted was that, and it's consistent with other areas of Minnesota law, people in Minnesota are considered legally competent unless and until a court makes specific factual findings in whatever the narrowest area possible is, that they have those decision-making powers taken away from them. So the proposal of changing the presumption only regarding voting to every one of these 23,000 people under guardianship is presumed to be incompetent to vote unless annually a court, whether anybody has raised the issue or not, has to reassess that and create an order stating either the status quo, whatever it is, continues, or it changes one way or the other, is quite a severe departure from current practice. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just a second.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, because we're talking about competency, what exactly would it take, what kind of information would a judge need to say you're either competent or not competent to vote? And would that require studies or just give me an idea about the kinds of information a judge would need on that?
I think there have been lots of discussions nationwide on this issue, and the American Bar Association standard seems to be one that is generally agreed to be pretty reasonable and that would not run afoul of equal protection questions because, as you know, many people vote who aren't possibly very well informed or but they are not banned from voting. There's not a knowledge test for voting. So the inquiry can't go beyond something that essentially determines whether the person understands the basic function of voting and is interested in voting and understands the choice that they have to make. That doesn't mean that the court is allowed to give them a civics quiz or have them rattle off the names of all the candidates and that kind of thing. It would be a very basic test of, does the person understand what voting is? Do they want to vote? And that would be the level of inquiry that the court should be making. And they do and should make that inquiry now. Other questions?
Any other questions for the witness? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Seeing none, Dan Severson. Mr. Severson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Dan Severson, retired Navy pilot, former fourth-term legislator, former Secretary of State candidate, and I'm speaking on behalf of Photo ID. The current election system is vulnerable and unaccountable. In 2008, same-day registrations in Minnesota totaled over 542,000, or 17% of the votes cast. Tens of thousands of those same-day registrations remain unverified today because the county attorneys have failed to do their job. At least three investigations since 2008 have been blocked by sitting county attorneys. In 2008, as a sitting representative, I personally conducted an in-depth look at voter fraud in St. Louis County, only to be blocked by the county attorney. Similar actions in Owatonna, Crow Wing County have resulted in filed affidavits from citizens being buried rather than forwarded to grand juries for investigation. This sort of short-circuiting enforcement process has perpetrated a ruse that there is no fraud in the election system. It is an unmistakable fact that there is no policing of the system by those who are mandated to have oversight over it. There needs to be a strengthening of the statute, and county attorneys need to be indicted under statute 201.275 for failure to perform their duties. In 2008, over 43,000 new Minnesota voter registration cards were submitted by ACORN, the Secretary of State's office. That was three-quarters of the new registrations in 2008. ACORN has been indicted under 12 other states for voter fraud. Minnesota's Secretary of State has failed on multiple levels to protect the integrity of our election system. During the 2008 election, he failed to update the state voter registration current felon list even after being warned weeks before the election, making victims of hundreds of prior convicted felons who voted believing they were eligible to vote. And I believe the Secretary of State made that statement in his statement today when he was talking about the voter from up in North Minnesota. That was directly a result of his incompetence in ensuring that the state voter registration system was updated. This mistake cost the Minnesotans tens of thousands of dollars in prosecution expenses and, more importantly, was likely a direct influence on the 2008 Senate recount results. Likewise, County Attorney Lori Swanson failed to investigate Minnesota Acorn for allegations of voter fraud. With the indictment of Acorn in other states, an investigation of Minnesota Acorn should have been a foregone conclusion. The fact that Lori Swanson and Mark Ritchie both received campaign funds from Acorns needs to be investigated by this legislature. The people of Minnesota deserve accountability for from their government,
Mr.
and that
Chair.
Responsibility falls to the legislature for oversight in these constitutional offices.
Excuse me. Senator Sieben?
Thank you, yep. Mr. Chair, but point of order, I'd just like to ask the witness how his testimony directly relates to the legislation before us. I think
Senator
we're
Sieben,
both aware we're
ask.
Under a tight timeline, and his comments seem to be straying quite a bit from the content of the legislation before us.
There'll be no the we would ask the audience to be respectful and not interrupt the committee proceedings. Senator Sieben, he does get a certain amount of time. Should we? I understand it's a little bit far afield, but if as long as you stay within the 3 minutes, I guess we'll.
Thank you, Mr.
That's
Chair.
That's right. Continue.
To that point, Mr. Chair. There are many reasons why photo ID needs to be enacted by this legislature, but one of the most important ones I will address is the military vote. Those who fight for our freedoms have been systematically disenfranchised by our current election system. In 2008, literally hundreds of military votes were rejected by a technicality put out by the Secretary of State's office in a December 7th memo. In 2010, less than 6% of the members eligible to vote in Minnesota were able to cast a vote that counted. Of the over 13,000 military that were eligible to vote in Minnesota in the general election in 2010, less than 800 ballots were received and counted. That's 94% of those who were fighting for our freedoms had no voice in the selection process. This speaks to those who advocate. And to that point, this speaks to that, to those who are advocating to retain the current system. They are supporting a system that disenfranchises our military. Why should our college students receive better treatment than those who are giving our military those we are giving for our military who are risking their lives for our freedoms? This is a clear violation of the 14th Amendment. The other issue, the 800 votes that were cast on Election Day in the Minneapolis precinct, of which 500 were same-day registrations. In that same precinct, a complaint was filed and a person sitting outside the polling place saying he would vouch for anyone who was voting for a specific party. Where are the results from the investigation 4 months after the fact? They're still pending. Photo ID is supported by 80% of the Minnesotans, regardless of party affiliation. It is the logical evolution of the 21st century technology that brings accountability to a broken and unaccountable system. The reasons the opponents bring up have been previously addressed by both the state and federal Supreme Courts. In both challenges, photo ID has been found constitutional. It is the responsibility of this institution to enact legislation of which these two bills bring forward. That provides the best protection for voting process and gives public confidence in their election system. I submit to you that after 14 months on the election, on the campaign trail, and talking with people from every corner of this state, confidence in our election system is an all-time low, and demand for photo ID is an imperative. Over 80% of Minnesotans want it, and the people of Minnesota have elected you to be their voice. Be their voice by reforming a broken system and telling them you are listening. Vote for photo ID. And I would just close with the statement, members, that there are very few issues that we'll deal with in the legislature that are 80% issues, very few. And when the public speaks with a resounding voice like that, it's incumbent upon the body of elected officials to listen. Thank you, and I'd stand for questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions for the witness? Okay, seeing none. Thank you very much. Gwen Myers, are you here? Welcome to the committee. If you could state your names for the tape. And who's going first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gwen Myers, and I am a board member of the League of Women Voters of Minnesota, and I have also served as an election judge for the last 10 years. The League believes that voting is a constitutional right that must be guaranteed in our democracy. Our 90-year-old organization was created by people, women, who were denied the vote until 1920, so we know what it's like to be shut out of the process. We have a special affection for suffrage. In addition, we are proud of Minnesota's election system, which is recognized as excellent by most people. It has been tested in two statewide recounts in the last 2 years. Attorneys on both sides in those contests searched for fraud and found it was not an issue. And in fact, there are no cases of voter impersonation ever in Minnesota. That is the only fraud a photo ID requirement for registered voters could prevent. The League considers two things when reviewing proposed changes in our election law. Does this change make the election process more accessible and less intimidating for the voter? And will this change exclude any group of citizens from the election process? When these questions are posed about Senator Howe's and Senator Limmer's bills, the League gets the wrong answer. Along with being costly to implement and completely unnecessary, these bills will deny the vote to United States citizens by adding to difficulty of same-day registration and by requiring registered voters to provide a current government-issued photo ID. And they will exclude some very specific groups of citizens. With me today are two League members who can illuminate some aspects of our objection to Senate File 479 and Senate File 509. Mary Lou Hill and Jessica Peterson-White. Mary Lou will go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mary Lou Hill, and I'm 94 years old. I was born in November of 1916, 4 years before the 19th Amendment gave women the right to vote. After just 70 years of unremitting effort on the part of women and men across the country, I learned about this struggle from my mother and my aunts who raised me in the Bryn Mawr area of Minneapolis. Soon after I reached the age of 21 in 1937, I registered to vote. It was like a rite of passage to full citizenship. For this reason, I urge you to oppose Senate File 479 and Senate File 509. Whatever the author's intentions, the effect of these bills will be to take the vote away from United States citizens by putting obstacles in their path to the voting booth. Require a government-issued photo ID from registered voters before they are allowed to vote will disenfranchise thousands of senior citizens. It is easy for one of you to run down to the government center to update your driver's license or to get a Minnesota ID. Senior citizens may have a number of problems with this simple activity. One, they may not drive and may not have anyone to take them. Two, they may not be able to walk without pain or at all. Three, if they are new to the state, they may have difficulty proving who they are. This is especially true for elderly women who have probably changed their names once or twice since they were born. One story, when she moved back to Minnesota, a friend wished to get a Minnesota ID card. She took the following to Hennepin County Government Center. Her birth certificate, her Arizona driver's license, her military ID, and her passport. They were not enough. Her name had changed since she was born. They wanted her marriage license. Fortunately, she had been married in Hennepin County and found the license in their records. If she had been married in Phoenix, she'd have been dealing with some office in Arizona state government and paying for a copy of her marriage license. You've all heard the statistic. 18% of people over the age of 65 do not have a current government-issued photo ID. That percentage must escalate rapidly as the age is increased. How many 94-year-old women do you suppose have a current photo ID? I do not. These bills will disenfranchise thousands of elderly citizens, citizens who have been proudly casting their ballots for 50 or 60 or 70 years. I urge you to vote no on Senate File 479 and Senate File 509. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you. Any questions for that witness?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Jessica Peterson-White. I was a lead election judge in Northfield during the last two elections, and I'm a member of the League of Women Voters. I'm speaking today in opposition to the provisions in SF 509 that eliminate vouching as a means of voter registration. Vouching allows a registered voter of the same precinct who has personal knowledge of another citizen's residency in that precinct to legally affirm that person's residence for purposes of election day registration. This provision has been allowed in Minnesota since 1973. As election judges, we are very careful to ensure that only personal knowledge of another's residence is ever used as the basis of vouching. The polling place where I work has multiple assisted living and nursing facilities, and residents of these facilities are a great example of why the vouching system is so important. On election day, we find that many elderly voters in the precinct have moved to a new address since the last election, often from an assisted living unit to a skilled nursing unit at the same facility. As election judges, we must make sure they are registered to vote at their new address, even though this address may only be across the street or next door to their previous one. They travel to the polling place on election day, often overcoming serious physical limitations, and find they need to re-register. Many do not have a phone, a utility bill, a lease, or a driver's license bearing their current address. They are vouched for by a fellow resident or an employee of the facility where they live. This is a population who are extremely committed to voting. They work hard to make it to the polling place. As election judges, we try to ensure they can exercise their franchise as they've done all their lives. Last November, we would have been forced to turn away many elderly citizens if vouching were not an option. Students in Northfield also register to vote by having someone vouch for them. Some live in off-campus housing in groups and do not have utility bills in every housemate's name. They receive other mail at their campus mailboxes. Because they are often from other states, the state does not require them to get a Minnesota driver's license when they are not permanent full-time residents, so they too would have been turned away from our polling place had they not been able to register through vouching. I do not believe that there are any instances of improper vouching for students in Northfield's polling places where we have a large student population. Election judges go in and out of the polling places, and the city clerk, staff, and other officials often stop by so that we are always aware of what is going on outside the polling place. As election judges, we feel responsible for the integrity of our election system. I am confident that the vouching system enhances that integrity. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the witnesses? Okay. Thank you very much. James Solms?
Yes, sir.
Would you like to testify?
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for having me. I've done this 20 years in Nevada. I've had to move back home because of health, and I love getting involved in my community.
Could you state your name for the tape, please?
I am James Solms, Medelia, Minnesota.
Thank you.
Born Wayzata, raised in Mound. Retired Honolulu police officer, 100% disabled veteran, a senior, longtime member of Minnesota Street Rod Association. As a policeman, I ended up on a state of Hawaii witness protection program because I stood up against corruption. I chose Las Vegas because of my classic cars and because of health. I moved back home here. One of the things I got involved in was the corrupt election issues in Nevada, and I wanted to relate. I know Arizona and Nevada are both kind of the same issues. The gentleman speaking earlier, because down there everybody wants the Hispanic vote. I was a foster parent in Hawaii, a foster parent in Nevada until my health couldn't allow me to do it anymore. And then, because involved in the car system and knowing the laws, I was asked to help make a difference in the state of Nevada because of the problem. In the early 90s, people were going out with clipboards, and I'm relating to Nevada problems, and I don't want to disrespect anybody. I don't know Minnesota, but I felt that the issues they had there in the voting, needing a photo ID, was so crucial down there that maybe I could bring some of the problems and maybe somebody would listen and correct. There would be people going out with clipboards, and they were getting paid $2 a signature by the Democratic Party down there. And if somebody didn't fill in their party affiliate, I'd watch them. They write in Democrat. You know, that kind of stuff shouldn't happen. Bringing it up to the county commissioners on the issues was, it got to be a deaf ear. And I got to say, backing up being law enforcement, Mr. Severson's testimony, I felt very well. Another issue was when they changed from the punch voting to the computerized voting. A group of us met with the manufacturers of the voting machines and found that if there was an employee in the county that wasn't honest, he could pre-program the computer, say, for Jane Doe, he could set it up that they already had 30% more votes than his person he's running against, so naturally that person would win because it was pre-programmed. So I don't know what type of machines you have here, but that's also a concern. You had, in this last election in Las Vegas, you had people being bussed from Harrah's and MGM, and it was in the newspaper, bussed to the voting polls, told who to vote for, and then they bought them lunches after they voted for the people they were told to vote for. One of the unions in Las Vegas used to have closed door with only Hispanic voters, and they would tell them who to vote for. One union put out a VHS tape to its members telling them who to vote for, which I have a copy of the tape. So it is so important to have a photo ID, you know, and people were bussed in from California and voted for the people in Nevada. It is so important from the law enforcement side to investigate. I'll volunteer my services free of charge, and I've told my representatives I will gladly, I know air quality like the back of my hand, I know the Constitution like at the back of my hand. And what it took to get it cleaned up is a phone call from me to the Office of Special Counsel in Washington, D.C., which Amber Bell and a lot of federal agents came out, and four county commissioners went to federal prison. You know, it shouldn't have to go that far. You know, let's continue. Let's stop buying the votes. Let's support the Constitution. Let God and churches help people. You know, I'm out there delivering lunches to seniors. I'm doing everything I can. You know, and I'll close on, let's check IDs so we know we have a legal voter. One of the things I was told when I first started Police Academy in Honolulu was the biggest organized crime unit in the United States was Washington, D.C. Why? And that was 40 years ago. So, like I said, I'm retired law enforcement. I'm 100% disabled veteran, and I would more than happy help anybody, but we need a photo ID. I moved back to Minnesota. I had no problem, got it the same day. I don't see what so many of these issues that these people say they're having to get an ID. I was born and raised here, and I came back here and didn't have a problem. And I thank you so much for letting me speak.
Thank you, Mr. Sones, especially for your service and
thank
for your
you.
Testimony here today. It's Pastor Paul Erickson. Are you here? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Pastor Paul Erickson. I work with the St. Paul Area Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. And I come before you today to speak in opposition to the bills requiring that people present photo identification in order to vote for three reasons. I believe it is discriminatory, it is expensive, and it is unnecessary. As I said, I work in the St. Paul Area Synod, which is a geographical cluster of over 110 congregations and almost 150,000 members in the East Metro area, many of whom are older adults and growing numbers of whom are poor and or belong to one of the many ethnic and immigrant communities, the very people who could well be disenfranchised by this requirement. Many of these individuals do not drive, and the time, energy, and expense required to obtain a photo ID would prove an unfair and discriminatory burden on them. Even if the state were to provide, as these bills suggest, free ID cards, spending funds that could be used elsewhere, there are many other costs involved in obtaining IDs, the documents required to get an ID, as have been others have said, expenses that would prevent many individuals from exercising their right to vote. They may need to travel or spend significant amounts of time or energy to obtain the passport or birth certificate or other documentation they need. In short, there is no such thing as free photo ID. And third, this requirement is unnecessary. Even after two of the most closely scrutinized elections in state history in recent years, not a single conviction for voter ID fraud has been obtained, the only kind of fraud this bill would address. While supporters of these bills may portray them as preventing possible hypothetical future fraud, they will have a very real and detrimental effect on people I have pledged my life to serve. So I urge you to reject the requirement of photo IDs for voting and focus our limited resources on issues that are much more real and pressing. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you for your testimony. Dorothy Fleming. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape, please.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Dorothy Fleming, and I'm a voter. I do live in Senate District 54. And I put out a note to a lot of people because I've been, you know, a supporter of photo ID since, well, a long time. And I put out a note saying that we've got over 80% of the people who support this. And then kind of as a side remark, I said, well, the other 20%, they already think we have it. And in response to that, a gal from Monticello sent me a note, and I asked her if I could share what she had to say. Her name is Stacy Morris, and she's from Monticello. I was an election judge in Monticello Township this past election cycle. My duty was getting people signed into the roster, giving them the receipt, and directing them to the judge with the ballots. Most people who came to sign the roster I was in charge of already had pulled their ID out. This was also the case of those who came in to sign with the judge seated next to me. When told that they didn't need to show their ID, they seemed surprised, and many thought that it was the law. Others said that it should be required and held their ID out anyway. Although I had no idea which way people were voting, I imagine the odds are they were all affiliated with one party, slim to none. This is truly, according to Stacy, a nonpartisan issue. She says our elected officials represent the citizens of their respective districts. Providing proof that voters are who they claim to be ensures that only citizens of the district are heard, be it House, Senate, Congressional, State, or Federal. And, of course, she speaks in favor of having photo ID. And this, of course, prompted me to start thinking of all kinds of, let's see, what hasn't been said on this, because for those of us who've been at the hearings and listening to all these, is there one more thing to get said? And I want you to know that I remember when there was a time when all voter registration was done in advance. And, you know, I can still remember, I know a lot of you can't, but I can remember those days. And back then, I will confess that a lot of us maybe didn't attach the value to that vote like we do today. Matter of fact, I feel like I was out working on a lot of other issues when all of this was taking place with regard to the changes. And I didn't foresee what was to come. It's like you start talking about how many people are going to get to vote and the opportunities, and we want everyone to be insured of that right and so on. But we didn't see where this was taking us. Consider for a moment, is there anything of value that's given to someone who has no identity? We need to, you know, you've heard the stories, we need to show an ID to see a doctor, to get a credit card and prescription and so on. Why would we not protect our vote by proving that we're residents of this state? In Minnesota, we have, for example, thousands of parks and lakes. We encourage people to use them. But to protect them, we have rules about their use, like posting for refuse or dog leashing and so on. Why? We regulate them because we value them. And I just, for me, I find it alarming that our privilege to vote is treated so lightly. The 2011 legislature has an opportunity to protect our vote and to make it count. And I challenge you on behalf of all of photo ID, please, to support it. It is necessary in Minnesota, and I do know it is wanted in Minnesota. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And ma'am, do you think that people who vote by absentee ballot should be required to show a photo ID?
Well, they have to register to vote first. But, oh, you mean they have to have been registered.
Mr. Chair and ma'am, but my question is, do you think people who vote by absentee should be required to show a photo ID?
Ms. Fleming.
They have to be able to have been registered in the first place.
Right. So
in order to get their ballot, at least when I've absentee balloted, that's what I did.
Actually, Senator Mr. Chair, to get an absentee ballot, you apply for it, but you don't necessarily show a photo ID. So I was asking then, how do you think the absentee ballot process should be changed?
In order to get, when I got my absentee ballot, I was registered to vote. The way the rule is now, you don't have to do anything, but you should have to register.
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, I don't think that's okay. Never mind.
Thank you. Any other questions for the witness? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Kathy Bloomfield, Carol Johnson, are you here? State your name for the tape, please.
Thank you. My name is Kathy Bonifield, and we're actually testifying on two separate issues, but she came up here with me. I am Kathy Bonifield, and I'm the Associate Director for Citizens for Election Integrity Minnesota. I'm also an international election observer with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And finally, I am an election judge. I'm here today to talk about the report I co-wrote with Carol Johnson, The report, Facts About Ineligible Voting and Voter Fraud, is based on a survey we sent out to county attorneys. As noted in the report, the survey went out last spring, with the earliest responses in mid-April and the latest in June. Thus, the report is a snapshot of the investigations. But it showed that the only type of fraud that had occurred was done through felons voting or felons registering to vote. A person's criminal status is not on a single piece of government-issued ID. This means a photo ID requirement will not prevent a felon from voting. The reason we conducted this survey was to determine if a photo ID requirement to vote would improve the integrity of Minnesota's elections. Before we sent out the survey, we had already known that the Brennan Center had determined that someone was more likely to be killed by a lightning strike than commit the type of fraud that a photo ID requirement would prevent. Since the only type of conviction was due to felons voting or registering to vote, our report findings match those of the Brennan Center. Again, this is due to the fact that a photo ID does not show someone's criminal status on it. As such, our first recommendation was not to institute a photo ID requirement to vote. But what is often overlooked are other recommendations within the report. We recommended that people with felony convictions should be informed they cannot vote. In fact, in 2009, with this requirement passed, the House with 118 people voting for it and 9 opposed, and in the Minnesota Senate with 47 people voting for it and 19 opposed. But Governor Pawlenty vetoed that bill. It's my hope that both the House and the Senate will pass a bill that requires people with felony convictions be informed that they lost the right to vote, and that Governor Dayton will sign that. I believe that will truly improve the integrity of our elections. There are two more recommendations in there. That Minnesota review, when it restores the civil rights to felons, and consider following North Dakota's example, which allows felons who are on parole and probation the right to vote. And in reviewing Minnesota statutes, we examined Minnesota Statute 204C.035, Deceptive Practices in Elections. That statute states that it is a gross misdemeanor for someone to knowingly deceive another person regarding the time, place, or manner of conducting an election or the qualifications for or restrictions on voter eligibility for an election with the intent to prevent the individual from voting in the election. We hope that this could be changed from a gross misdemeanor to a felony with a requirement to serve time, thus disenfranchising someone who intentionally disenfranchised others. We believe our recommendations improve the integrity of Minnesota's elections and that bills that propose photo IDs and provisional ballots miss the mark. All our recommendations are supported by two of the three former Minnesota Secretaries of State, Arlen Erdahl and Joan Groh. I would like to conclude this by reiterating the only type of conviction in the majority of the investigations were due to felons. And since someone's criminal status is not on their ID, a photo ID requirement is not a solution.
Any questions for this witness? Okay, thank you for your testimony.
I'm Carol Johnson. I am an election judge in Minneapolis. And thank you, Chairman and Mr. and members of the committee for listening to me. Minnesota's election system, in my opinion, and several others, including the three-panel Supreme Court judge that ruled in the most recent recount, have said that Minnesota's election system works exceedingly well for all its citizens. The election judges work diligently and effectively and with few mistakes. Minnesota's reputation for clean and fair and transparent elections has been validated by the two statewide recounts and the post-election audits, which are like mini recounts, and the recent survey of the 87 county attorneys. I've been involved in elections for 40 years, starting with neighborhood elections, and changes have always been made to make voting more accessible to Minnesotans. And I believe that Senate File 479 and 509 does just the opposite. It adds cost and confusion to the election day operation at the polls, with the provisional ballots being very confusing, just when we have made improvements to the absentee ballot system. For 17 years, I've been the election judge in one of Minnesota's largest precincts. We have 2,500 registered voters, and we can register up to about 400 day on election day. We had an 86% voter turnout in the last presidential election, and the only time we had any lines was at the opening of the polls, and they weren't much longer than a half an hour. Our registration table, a person waits maybe 5 or 10 minutes or less. And I understand that it's different in other communities that have higher same-day voter registration. So each precinct is different and has different costs. I foresee this voting process that's being suggested, it will slow things down greatly. And people will come to the polls to vote. Minnesotans vote in large numbers. We've been leading the nation for several years through many Secretary of State's administrations. I think they're going to feel that it's unnecessary to have this bureaucratic function that accomplishes nothing but making voting more cumbersome and disenfranchises hundreds and thousands who have no need for a photo ID. A photo ID does not accomplish its purpose. The fact has been verified by the survey of the 87 counties, who by law investigate, charge, and prosecute anyone suspected of voting irregularities. The data shows that in 2008 elections, there were zero prosecutions for voter fraud that could be prevented by a photo ID requirement. Voters sign their life on the line each time they write their signature in the poll book when reaffirming the oath of voter eligibility. Giving false information is punishable by not more than 5 years imprisonment or a $10,000 fine or both, and this is one of many safeguards in the Minnesota election system. Good legislation should be based on facts, not because it's popular. By repeating exaggerations and untruths often enough, it soon becomes the truth, an urban or a rural myth. There were zero prosecutions for voter fraud in 2008 that could be prevented by photo ID requirement. Voter fraud is not a problem in Minnesota. I urge you to put aside these, in my opinion, ill-considered bills. You have an important role as a state senator to honor the constitutionally protected right, the right of all Minnesotans to vote. Thank you for hearing me, and I you can be proud when you improve the system of our voting in Minnesota.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Senator Chamberlain.
Oh, he has a question.
Just either one of you can answer this question. It's been brought up quite a bit. Is that if we don't have a system to help prevent and detect voter fraud, then it's not unusual to have few or no reports of voter fraud. And if we have few or no reports of voter fraud, it then follows that the county attorneys will say we have no problem. Could you respond to that, either one of you?
Senator, Chair? I understand what your question is, and your question is if there's no reports of it, it may not exist. But the question, of course, is there are ways of finding out if someone has committed fraud, voter impersonation. For example, many people actually are election judges in precincts that are near their home. Carol is an election judge in her home precinct. My mother was an election judge in her home precinct. So she knows her neighbors. My mother has grown up in my hometown. So she knows people that come in there, and as do other election judges. So if someone were to come in and say that they were Helen Miller, my mother would know, no, you're not Helen Miller, that's my neighbor. Further, other judges would feel the same way. Also, if the woman named Helen Miller came in later and saw that it was signed, they would say, there's an indicator of voter impersonation. But we didn't hear anything like that occurring. So there are ways of of or indicators of that, but there haven't really been any indicators.
Mr. Chair, a couple of quick things.
Senator Chamberlain.
You're familiar with the U.S. Supreme Court decision regarding Indiana?
Mm-hmm.
And you're familiar with the Baker-Carter report that talked about precincts being much larger than they were in 1930?
Mm-hmm.
And all due respect, but I wouldn't know everybody voted in my precinct either. And secondly, and then I'll let you answer, the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court 6-3 ruling, you're also familiar with the part where it says it refers to the part where it remains that although Indiana didn't have any reports of the voter fraud, not the felon piece, but the voter fraud, that there is still, because it happens other places in the United States, and that we have had cases, some cases here, that it happens other places in the United States, it's a legitimate concern of the state to have a system that does not unduly burden people to get those photo IDs. So comment on those two pieces, and then that's all for me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Chair, I have read some interesting reports about voter disenfranchisement in Indiana. The Brennan Center, which I haven't reported on, they found that more people were disenfranchised in Indiana because of their photo ID law than investigations of voter impersonation in the United States. So we have one state that instituted something based on fears or urban myths. When they found out that they did that, they actually disenfranchised a large number of voters. So I don't know if that answers your question. If not, please ask.
I don't know if the committee and the chair is aware, but there was an indictment of the Secretary of State in Indiana of voter fraud as being one of the indictments. And so we have laws that we expect, and we have systems in checking. The Secretary of, our auditor's office checks all of the newly registered voters and the voters after the election, and they are followed up, as you talked about, by the postal return card. And there were, 399 postal returns? Any information is transferred to our poll books, and then the election judges challenge the individuals should they appear ahead of time. The big thing here, I think, that is forgotten
Johnson,
is
we have to get out of this room, so if you could wrap it up.
I think people make mistakes, and people are unaware, and that's what we need to do in this election system, as the Secretary of State testified, is to do a better job of informing felons, and I think we're going to see any voter fraud go down immensely. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, we are going to recess until 7 p.m. and meet in room 112. But if you could put your stuff in your packets that you want to save, and we'll take up there. Senator Kaler.
How late are we going to go?
Until we're done. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
We will be voting on it tonight. We are recessed until 7 p.m. in room 1.